Hi, I'm Jim Shear, host of 180 Degrees, a podcast brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. In this series, I talk to climate leaders about how they first connected to the urgent need for climate action. We go back to their roots and talk about their journeys, discover what drives them and what keeps them motivated. We also explore the essential ingredients required for leadership on climate action here in Ireland and how we might impact internationally. Nothing short of a societal movement is now needed to ensure a livable planet for our children and future generations. This episode of the podcast was recorded live in front of an audience at the Ivy Garden Hotel in Dublin. So just to set up the conversation a little bit, Sharon's been kind enough to listen to the six episodes that we recorded for this season. And they were with Liz Bonnen, wildlife and natural history presenter and broadcaster, including with the BBC, Eamon Ryan, Minister for Environment, Climate, Communications and Transport, Davy Phillip, who's a community catalyst down in Tipperary, Clough Jordan Eco Village. He's 20 years experience working with communities. Professor John Sweeney might be known to many of you. He's one of Ireland's top climate scientists from Maynooth University. Educator and activist Rachel Dempsey, who through her business supports connection, wisdom and resilience for thriving people and planet. And Lorna Gold, a director of movement building at Faith Invest, doing amazing work with Pope Francis and others on accelerating climate action globally. All super committed people, a passionate bunch of people with fascinating views that they shared on the podcast, so please do listen. Those episodes are going to be released in the coming weeks, and today Sharon and I are going to attempt to pick up on some of the themes that we both heard during those podcasts. But Sharon, who I also know to be a very committed, passionate and powerful actor on climate here in Ireland, we're really going to use this time to get to know you and your experience and career as well, and your views on dealing with this climate emergency. So I want to get started with kind of a typical interview style question, which is if you could tell us a little bit about your career to date and how you ended up in your current role at the EPA.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks for having me. And it's great to be here, and it's a real privilege to be asked. And having listened to the podcast, I think people are going to really enjoy them. There's a real richness in terms of the discussion and some of the thoughts and the energy and whatever that comes off it. So it's great to be part of it. So, yeah, I'm currently, as you said, director of the Office of Environmental Sustainability in the EPA. But I'm only recently joined the EPA, having been in the Department of the Taoiseach for 20 years. And I suppose I started out, you know, kind of graduate straight in from university. And I've been lucky enough, I suppose, in the role in the Taoiseach's department to have done all sorts of really, really interesting things there. So I was worked on the North. I worked on Northern Ireland for a considerable period of time. I was there for the St Andrews Agreement and for the restoration of the Northern Ireland Executive in 2006. So it was really, really interesting kind of high-octane political times in international negotiations. I then, following on from that, I kind of got my first toe in the water as regards kind of environmental policy when I was put in the economic policy unit in the department, which part of that role would have been, it has had lots of different aspects to it, but one of them was looking at climate change and looking at environmental issues. And that was kind of 2007, 2008, when it wasn't the kind of the hot topic that it is now at the moment. But I was really, really personally interested in it. And when you work particularly in a central government department, you're constantly kind of encountering people who know a lot more about things than you do, because by its very nature, you need to be kind of have a high level view over lots of things. But I felt really, I suppose I felt that information asymmetry really acutely in relation to climate action. And so at that time, I looked around to see what could I do in terms of upskilling myself kind of academia wise. And I looked around to see whether part-time courses that I could do in Ireland, and there weren't at the time. Now that vista has changed happily and there's loads of courses you can do now. But I went and did a course on climate change impacts and adaptation and mitigation in the University of Copenhagen. And that was really quite a kind of a transformational moment for me, because it was an amazing course. It was quite brief, you know, 6 or 8 months, but involved traveling over to Copenhagen, and they have an amazing facility there to look at the ice cores. You know, they have the ice cores in storage, and you can go and have a look and see, you know, what actually the science is telling you about the amount of carbon that's stored and so on. So that was a kind of a light bulb moment, if you like, for me. But kind of the nature of the beast in the civil service is you get moved around. And so I went on to become the head of economic policy in Taoiseach's immediately after the kind of the financial crisis. So that was at a time where we were all talking about, you know, the level of unemployment, the national debt, our capacity to access debt markets, all of those things. And my focus was really on that at the time. And then I went on maternity leave, came back and was given the role of leading the 2016 commemorations. So that was a really kind of totally different space to be in. Went on another mat leave, came back and got given the role of leading the Citizens Assembly, which was on a number of topics, including abortion and climate change. But I came back from the climate change, from that time working on climate change. I spent probably 6 or 7 months just dedicated looking to climate change. And again, it was like this kind of light bulb moment. I'd come back around to it and thought, we as a state and as a central government, we really, really need to actively do something much more significant with this. And I had this moment where coming back off my another mat leave, I was going back into the job, and I have never really sort of sought out a job in the civil service. You know, normally you just kind of get moved around. But I had thought to myself, I'm going to speak to the Secretary General and I'm going to say to him, listen, we need to set up a climate action unit and I want to head it up because I think this is really important. So we were to meet for a coffee and we sat down, and instead of me saying that to him, he said that to me. And so that was like an amazing kind of alignment of minds. And so I went and did that and set up the first climate action unit in the Taoiseach's department, at, you know, running at a senior level with really good team around me, including somebody from SEAI who we had gotten on secondment from yourselves. And I was working on that. And then this opportunity came up to work in the EPA. And I suppose I was really struck by the fact that I had, during my time in the Citizens Assembly, I talked to a lot of people in the EPA, and I was really struck by their professionalism, their knowledge, their expertise, their access to the data, their real deep understanding of what's happening in relation to the environment. And I thought, what would happen if me, with a really deep experience and understanding of how government works, was to go into that organisation with that level of understanding of what's actually happening, and what kind of partnership might that bring about? So that was my kind of lightning moment to go for the job and then ultimately get it. Yeah.
It's a really rich career path to date. So there's loads there we can draw on in this conversation. A lot of the other guests talked as well about their motivation for doing work on climate, whether it's, you know, we had people who grew up by an oil refinery in Scotland, and they were waking up to the flare every morning and they got curious about that, and that started their journey. Or someone took a trip to Australia and got connected with the natural world there. Another guest started as a pro skateboarder and a businessman, and got jaded on that process and said, no, I need to do something about the climate, and got involved in community work and I guess found his calling that way. I won't mention the names of these people. You have to listen to the episodes to find out who they are. And a lot of people talked about something that is innate in all humans in terms of values and connection. Copenhagen sounded like a bit of a moment for you where things took a bit of an acceleration. Was there a time before, or was it that really got you or keeps you motivated on the climate game and contributing in that place?
Yeah, I suppose that probably was the moment for me. And I suppose the thing that maybe motivates me more than anything is I just feel like, I suppose, you know, when you're working in an organization now, as I currently am, where you're seeing the evidence constantly coming at you, you know, because as a member of the EPA board, you're also looking at what's happening right across the organization, not just in my area. And, you know, it's quite startling, actually, a lot of the evidence of what's happening. And I guess maybe some of those issues that I talked about that I've worked on in other parts of my career, whether it be on Northern Ireland or on the economic crisis or, you know, the Citizens Assembly, I have a very strong view that actually when you have a really challenging problem, you know, the key thing is to break it down into small parts, put your shoulder to the wheel and actually focus on delivering and working through the problem. And a lot of the time it's not, you know, there's obviously really important, clever leadership that's required, and there's deep thinking that's required around the solutions. But actually, and one of the things that's been at the hallmark, I think, of climate action in Ireland is the deficit of implementation. And actually, just a focus, to be able to focus on that, that's the thing that really motivates me. It's to understand what's driving that implementation deficit, and to think about what can I do to bridge it based on the experience that I have. Because that's that's for me is just consistently the issue in, with climate change in Ireland. It's that, and we see it in our EPA figures. It's just this you know, really ambitious targets, really clear goals, and then a lack of ability to get there. And I feel really strongly, maybe perhaps now is the time where we could be tipping that balance in terms of the state's kind of attention to the issue. And so for me, that's the thing. I'm like, how can I ensure, based on my experience, that I can play my part to make sure that happens?
Got it, yeah. And let me ask you about the data then, because you've been nearly a couple of years now in the EPA role. Yeah. You're seeing a lot of data on waste and on energy statistics and those kinds of things. And EPA is, of course, responsible for reporting on Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions and how we're performing against various targets. So can I ask you what you see in the data and what you see more broadly as the state of play when it comes to climate action in Ireland?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we recently published our national inventory for 2021, and we've been, again, to this idea of how do you ensure that the data actually makes a difference and actually impacts. So we've been really working with the team to see, to try and get the data out as quickly as possible, because in my previous roles, like, so say, for example, in the middle of the economic crisis, one of the hallmarks of that discussion at that time was, you know, we had such a rich availability of data to decision makers about what was actually happening. So we consistently saw, you know, quarterly figures coming out from the CSO about our unemployment rate, our employment rate, you know, all of these things which were directly impacting on policy. You know, so the policymakers were looking at this and thinking, okay, the interventions that we're making in the policy system are not having an impact here. So we need to change our intervention in order to, you know, so there was a real correlation between what the system was doing and what the figures were saying. And what I've been trying to do since I arrived in the EPA is to try and accelerate our data and make it more timely and more available in a more timely way, so that that connection and that disconnect, and actually was one of the things that John Sweeney talked about in his podcast, that you know, that this, how do we ensure that there's a greater connection between the public and the policymaker and the data and the policymaker? And I think that's a really important point. So, like, what we're seeing in the last emissions inventory that we published is for 2021, we saw our greenhouse gas emissions go up by 4.7%. And that was driven primarily by the energy sector, because energy emissions went up by 17%. And that was driven by the fact that we've had less wind, but also we had switched back on Money Point, and the emissions coming from coal were very significant. We also saw our agriculture emissions go up by 2% or 3%. We're seeing kind of continuing increases in that sector. We saw transport emissions go up now only by 6%. And I suppose one of the things to note is that 2021 was the year after the big kind of collapse of activity because of the pandemic. And so transport emissions still aren't back as where they were pre the pandemic. So there's a little bit of cause for maybe cautious optimism there. But at the same time, I think if you go out and you try and drive down the street at the moment, you're maybe seeing a full rebound of that. So we'll see how that comes through. So frankly, the greenhouse gas emissions figures don't instill you with a huge cause for optimism. But at the same time, what maybe does give us cause for optimism is that we have now a legislative and an administrative system which is completely changed, you know, with the arrival of the Climate Action Bill, which is completely designed to drive this change. And instead of having targets which were legally binding at EU level, now we have limits, and that I'm hoping will give us a completely different way of looking at it. But one of the things I suppose maybe to mention, that having previously worked on climate and been really focused on climate, one of the things I've been really struck by the EPA in the EPA is the extent to which there are all sorts of other red flags going up around our environmental indicators. And again, one of the things that Minister Ryan talked about in his podcast was, you know, how will we know when we've reached tipping points? How will we know when we've reached across them? Are we paying enough attention to the data to know these things? And there have been so many examples of things that I've seen, you know, because I'm on the EPA board, and you're watching and more carefully observing, I suppose, what's coming out. But like things like our rivers and our the quality of our rivers and lakes. 30 years ago, we had 500 pristine rivers in Ireland, and now we have 20. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just find that so shocking. It's so shocking. Mm-hmm. Every time I say it, I'm still shocked by it. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of other examples like that in relation to biodiversity and so on. And the EPA publishes a report every 4 years called the State of the Environment Report, which really gives a really clear assessment of where our environment is at. And really, in lots and lots of areas, it's not a good picture. So, you know, it's hard to be confronted by the data and not be sort of blue about it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I felt the same way recording the other episodes, and certainly with John Sweeney, you're hearing from one of the top climate scientists in Ireland about, you know, the stark reality of where we're at.
Yeah.
You talk about the power of data, you know, to really get things happening, but and the importance of communicating that data in ways that people can take it and act on it.
Yeah.
I felt with the guests this season that there's sort of a general appreciation that things have moved on in recent years when it comes to climate policy and in terms of organisation, establishment of that legislative basis that you mentioned, very strong targets, climate action plans, almost as if we have the border of the puzzle put together, which is the bit you start with, but there's still a lot of challenges around the how-to to complete the rest of the puzzle. So we discussed a lot of ideas over the course of this season's podcast around what people felt was missing or could be given increased focus when it comes to accelerating climate action. And I think I picked up on a couple of ideas in your last answer there, but what if anything, do you think is missing from the current conversations or of the things that people are talking about, what could use a greater focus?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, like when I was working on the Citizens Assembly, and for those of you who aren't familiar with it, we were given 5 topics by government. The final topic was climate change, and it was added in at the end. It was by the Green Party tabled an amendment when the Oireachtas resolution was being finalised to include this item on climate change. So it was, I suppose, an afterthought, you could describe it as. And what was really interesting as part of that was the citizens themselves. So we began the discussion and we spent 6-7 months dealing with abortion, and it was, you know, the whole state was watching what we were doing on the abortion topic. But what was really interesting was lots of members of the Citizens Assembly, of the 100 citizens who were selected to come, decided to take part because they wanted to discuss climate change. So they decided to sit through all of the other topics in order to get to have a conversation about climate change. And that really struck me at the time as being quite strange.
Especially for an afterthought that was added.
And then what was really interesting was in the assembly process, you know, one of the kind of hallmarks of the process was to give the citizens agency, you know, to give them control over the process. And so that one of the citizens put the question to us, could we reorder the work? You know, could we do climate change earlier? And their big concern was that the government could fall and as a result, the Citizens' Assembly might fall and we might not get to climate change. And this member of the Assembly voiced this concern and it was shared by everybody. And as a consequence, we voted and we did it. We ended up doing a third. And I suppose this question about, you know, what could we do better? I came away from that process and from like the results that came out from the Citizens Assembly were, you know, a lot of people at the time thought, God, you know, do people really want these recommendations? You know, how representative are these citizens? You know, they were quite far-reaching recommendations, recommending increases in our carbon taxes and all sorts of things. And, you know, so there was this question about, you know, were they a representative? Do people really want this? And I felt really strongly coming out of that, actually, people do really want this. And what we need to do is do a much better job in communicating with them. And actually, since I've been with the EPA, we've done a piece of research with Yale University called Climate Change in the Irish Mind. And what that is a representative sample of 4,000 Irish citizens to see what their views are on climate change. And that shows us that there is really strong acceptance in the Irish population that climate change is happening. Like over 85% of the population accept that climate change is happening. And 2/3 of those believe that it's happening solely as a result of human-induced activity. So, that, you know, the core message of science is well understood by the Irish public. 90% of the public really feel that Ireland should be doing more as a country. So this kind of narrative that's out there about, oh, you know, we're too small to do anything, that's actually not accepted based on evidence by the public. And why am I saying all this to answer your question? It's because I really feel that there's this very strong commitment in the values of the Irish people about wanting to take action on climate change. And what's missing, in my view, is a really forensic examination of how do we communicate with people properly to deliver that message to them. And I really contrast how we're going about it, as a potential way of doing it, how we did Brexit, for example, how we did communications on Brexit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've forensically dissected who we needed to talk to in terms of stakeholders, the public, businesses, right across the economy, and we did a very sophisticated communications campaign. When you look at what we did with COVID, that's what we need on climate. And for me, that's the piece that needs to change. That's the real gap that I see. And and from the EPA's point of view, what our research allows us to do is to demonstrate, give a clear understanding of what people think, but also what we want to be able to use that research is to try and help those who are communicating on climate to say, this is how you communicate with different personas and different people across the Irish economy and society, because there isn't a one message suits all in relation to anything really when you're communicating. But I think it's particularly relevant in the area of climate. Yeah. And actually, it's that sort of failure to address that can lead to that kind of divisive narrative that sometimes exists in relation to climate. So what's really, really needed is putting significant resources on this and getting it right, getting the communications piece right.
Yeah, it came up with every guest. We had guests talking about there being a crisis of imagination. We haven't done enough work to really envision the future and see that and get a sense of what it might be like to live into a positive future for everyone. We had other guests talking about how to use the media to get message across to make sure it lands. So, and you're picking really up on that same thing. We had others talking about using storytelling. One of our guests actually wrote a book called Climate Generation, Lorna Gold. And we had others sort of the need for deep listening, really, to understand all the different groups of people that we need to get enrolled in this idea that this needs to be a big, big national effort.
Yeah, and on the deep listening thing, I mentioned in relation to the Citizens' Assembly, this question of agency and giving agency to the citizens. And what agency essentially is that deep listening. And my experience in the Assembly was that oftentimes that deep listening and trying to hear what the people are saying and not just think, okay, I have a plan of how we're going to deliver a work programme for this Citizens' Assembly and here it is and this is a linear path we're going to go on, but to actually listen and continuously gather people's thoughts and engage and amend your work programme as a result and think about going at it a different way because that's the input that they've made to you and being responsive to that and the goodwill that generates when you do that with, in this case, the group of 100 citizens and how much richer it is as a result of that. And my experience in the Assembly was really challenging. It was really, really challenging because it brought you to places that certainly as a conservative kind of civil servant, you wouldn't necessarily go, but it was so enhanced and enriched as a result of that.
Did you hear surprising things that you weren't expecting to hear or?
Yeah, I suppose throughout the process, there were suggestions that were made that I just would never have come up with. Say, for example, one of the things we did, and it kind of speaks to Davy's point about engaging with communities, one of the things we did was, what the government had asked and what the Oireachtas had asked us to do was to look at how the state could make Ireland a leader in tackling climate change. And so the way we approached the work programme was we did an examination of each of the sectors where the greatest greenhouse gas emissions were coming from. We did a, here's what Ireland looks like now, and then if we were to be a leader, what would we need to do to get there? But the citizens were sort of talking about, actually, we need real-life examples of that. That's quite intangible for us. How do we get a sense of actually what that looks like? And so we brought in speakers across each of the sectors who were kind of living that, so we had Paul Kenny from the Tipperary Energy Agency, for example. We had a guy from Dublin City, the Dublin Fire Brigade Service, who had completely retrofitted. You know, so we had all of these real life examples that the citizens could connect with, and it's that, I suppose, that feeling that was really clear, that people could see. They didn't argue with the science. They didn't argue with the okay, this is where we are and this is where we need to get to, and that there are technological solutions to get us there. There are known policy levers to get us there. But it's the how do we get there? And can you please explain that to us? And can you please show me how it's done? That's the piece that I probably, you know, off the bat, you wouldn't necessarily have automatically included in the work programme, but that's what made it connect for people, for the citizens. And that's precisely what I think the communications campaign that the whole state needs to engage in needs to be able to do. And we saw that with COVID. You know, it was a mixture of here's the science. It was a mixture of here's the steps the government's taking. Here's the steps we need you to take. Mm-hmm. And here's some storytelling of what has happened if people don't follow the policy or if they do. So it's a really kind of rich, sophisticated engagement, but it's challenging. And I think it is really challenging because you're inevitably going to probably make mistakes in communicating that. And that kind of fear of alienation, I think, can hamper any progress, you know, because you're afraid that if I make a misstep here, you know, there's going to be such negative coverage of it, and as a result, there's a kind of a paralysis that sets in around how to communicate on climate. So we just have to get over that, actually, and get into realizing that communication and telling and explaining to the public why it is we're doing the policy we're doing has to be the foundation stone of each of those policy levers. Like when you look at the detail that's in the Climate Action Plan currently, you see a really sophisticated setting out of, you know, all of the policy levers that are going to be required across each of the sectors. And I often think, you know, what's missing is this, how are we going to engage the citizen as part of that, as part of the policy development? And actually, if you look, the most recent, my former colleagues in the Department of the Taoiseach, they are constantly reporting, and they do quarterly progress reports. But one of the things that they do is they point to the systemic issues that they're seeing happening across the state as regards why some of the measures aren't being delivered. And one of the things that they pointed out in their most recent report is failure to stitch in time for community engagement or public engagement. That this is emerging as a key issue. And I think unless and until we recognise that and not just have it as a communications add-on chapter, it has to be fundamental to everything we do.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation that, you know, we have more detailed climate action plans. There's a lot of the policy how-to. Yeah. There's a lot of the technology trajectories. And then there's this whole bottom-up movement that maybe it sounds like you're saying we could connect better with. And your experience with the Citizens Assembly, I guess is a living illustration of what it means to be, to open, listen, to come up with a report, and then to give, I guess, politicians a platform on which to act. That they know is acid tested with the populace, and obviously the climate movement is gathering momentum all the time. How has that process of the Citizens Assembly and everything you just described influenced how you as a civil servant communicate to politicians or to the general public? Or
Well, I suppose the most profound impact that it had on me was probably just this question of ensuring expertise is part of how we make our decisions. And that's not to say that it wasn't part of it beforehand, but, you know, like a lot of the way in which the Citizens Assembly was structured, we had an expert advisory group who helped us kind of design the work programmes for each of the topics. But also we had experts that we invited in, you know, and it was just so profoundly enlightening. And actually, when you had a mechanism like we did with the Assembly, that you're actually actively working with academics and experts with a destination point in mind, you know, where they were sort of forced into having a deadline and having something to work towards that was real, and they could see that, you know, the engagement with the Oireachtas was on the horizon. Actually, having that common purpose in that team that I was working with was really, you know, very, very powerful. And I suppose that was probably one of my biggest takeaways, you know, in a global sense, is like, how do we, there are so many people out there, particularly in the climate space, who really, really want to do something in this space. And actually, you know, my experience in my career has been, it's that personal connection and that kind of building alliances with people and kind of setting out your vision and bringing people with you, them setting out theirs, you amending yours because of how they've influenced you. That's how you get stuff done, you know.
Is that a particular strength in Ireland? I'm not from here. I've been here 16 years, but every time I introduced you to someone from our marketing team earlier, and you both knew the same person, and the way you're talking about that citizens assembly and the excitement of the citizens or the energy lifting when they got close to the government circle, and there doesn't seem to be a great lot of distance there in that process. Like the citizens are talking to the politicians, and they are us, and they want to work with us, and that kind of thing. Is that something that, you know, we can show the world? You know, and bigger countries that perhaps don't have those kind of connections.
Yeah.
You know, as a shining example, Ireland punches above its weight. You hear that all the time, you know, and that sounded like a process that it could be replicated globally from Ireland, you know, experimenting in that way.
Definitely. On the assembly, I mean, like it's five years ago since I ended, and I still do interviews on the Citizens Assembly about once a fortnight. Like there is huge interest internationally in it. And what we've done, and so many books been written about it and everything. So absolutely. But like from my perspective, looking at the climate piece, we have all of these skills. You know, we are as a nation, we are extraordinary good diplomats. We are, you know, excellent storytellers. We are, you know, when we're faced with a crisis like we were with COVID, we did an amazing job of dealing with it. And I'm just really hoping that we're now at the point where the collective endeavours of our, like we have an extraordinary, well-talented public service, I think. And I think if the moment has come that the public service believes that this is the time we need to tackle climate change, I have no doubt that we will be able to do it, we'll be able to grasp it. But it's that moment. Have we tipped over into that moment yet? And if the if the civil service and if the public service and if the politicians and if all of those in decision-making roles haven't yet realised that we are in that moment, because we all know we are in that moment. The evidence shows us that we are in that moment. The IPCC tells us we're in that moment. How do we ensure that we tip that over? And I suppose that kind of comes back to that point about why I went and joined the EPA, because I really feel that's what we need to be doing. We need to be communicating that message that we are here, we are at that moment. And actually, I think the onus is then on the public service to take the grasp the nettle and make it clear, I suppose, kind of plow that path so that when there are these difficult decisions and some of these policies that we know we have that need to be implemented, which are challenging. And we know from our research on climate change in the Irish mind that people want these policies. There's huge support for these policies, but there's sort of this intention and action gap that exists. And what do we do in order to smooth that gap? And our partner with the climate change in the Irish mind research in Yale, Tony Leesowich, he talks about that actually it's the policymakers' role to try and smooth that gap and bring that gap together. And so, like, I kind of feel that what the policymaking system needs to be thinking about is how do we ensure that when the pinch point comes for some of these policy levers with the public, that they have invested so much time and effort in bringing the public along, that those political challenges aren't there to the extent that they are currently. And I think until such time as we kind of turn that corner and realise that that's where the real work has to be done, that's the piece I think that will unlock it.
You get a real sense of the critical time that we're in right now in this moment, and the need to act, and that's really coming from the data, and you can see as the emissions don't start trending down if they don't start trending down very sharply now, that the type of measures and things that we have to do almost look more extreme in the time period, you know, in the immediate period and in the long term to get to net zero and these other goals. So that sort of does bring home to me that kind of that need to really get the communication right. And it sounds like you're talking about, you know, building knowledge and awareness amongst citizens so that when it comes, you know, they're ready and willing to act. And we talked earlier about the connection to values and how we might drive that. So I think that's really important. We've seen a massive youth movement globally and here in Ireland over recent years in particular. And young people are really crying out for older generations to get our act together. And that's what we're talking about here today. How do you feel when you hear calls like these from younger people?
My overwhelming feeling whenever I see them is guilt. Like, I feel really guilty because I feel like I'm in this position and I can be doing more. So I should be doing more. So, like, that's my overwhelm. Whenever I see the climate strikers, that's this feeling, it's the strong feeling I get. I'd be a little bit dismayed by people who kind of look at the climate strike movement and the young people and everything, you know, their huge enthusiasm and their, I mean, it's incredible what they've been doing and their the clarity with which they speak and the messages they have. It would be a huge mistake, I think, for us to say, aren't they great? Isn't that so inspiring? And therefore, we've nothing to do, you know, because they're coming up and it'll be okay because once they're in power, it'll be okay. Because actually, my experience, like 20 years in the system, is that the system will just continue the way it always has done. And so you can't expect just this cohort of people to come in and just because they're there, that it'll miraculously change. So that kind of number one feeling of the time is now and it's on me. You know, that's the feeling that it gives me when I look at it on a daily basis.
One of the chants outside the door from the group that were gathered there was we are unstoppable. Another world is possible. Does it inspire you to be a little more gamey at work, you know, to really put it out there and take a few more chances and be willing to get things wrong, but to try?
I mean, I absolutely. And, you know, like in my previous role, we did some really good work with Coraline and Noe just on some kind of really basic things. But it was, again, really challenging. And we kind of adopted that approach from the Citizens Assembly, giving them loads of agency and trying to think about, it was just a really simple project that we did with them around a kind of a climate literacy tool. And they were really inspiring. They really challenged us, you know, to think about, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. And, you know, it was kind of like a climate dictionary or, you know, a kind of a glossary. But on the one level, it was really basic, perfunctory kind of thing that we were doing with them. But actually, the engagement with them and the listening to their perspective on it was much deeper than that. And, you know, you just learned so much more. So it was very inspiring. And, you know, you have to kind of draw. I think if you're working in climate, and I know I've loads of colleagues and friends working in it, like, it can be challenging to not burn out and to not feel this sort of sense of doom. And and so when you see how active young people are, you know, you have to kind of take the energy from that and think there is a future that we're working towards that will be different. And like, to back to your point about kind of Ireland as a leader, and I think John Sweeney was kind of talking about this, you know, we have shown, for example, in our decarbonisation of our energy generation, like, that we can be leaders, notwithstanding greenhouse gas emissions for last year and what happened with coal. There was a whole confluence of unusual circumstances that led to that and probably will see the same type of emissions in the next year or two anyway. But we know we can do onshore renewable. We know we're going to be able to do offshore renewable. We know we can be a leader in that space. And there's nothing to say that we can't be in other areas. And it's just that kind of, you know, when you look back, and I think the minister mentioned it in his podcast around Ard na Cruiche and what was done there in the 20s. I mean, you know, the vision that was in the country at that time, and our capacity as a country to have dealt with so many different challenges over the years, you know, whether it be Northern Ireland, whether it be dealing with the economic collapse and the, you know, and our incredible turnaround following that, which was extraordinary, You know, we are able to do these things, and you just have to really hope, look into the future, that we can have a situation where, you know, by 2050, we're saying our greenhouse gas emissions have reduced, where our rivers and our lakes have been restored. You know, yeah, you absolutely have to believe that that future is in front of us.
Yeah. I think that, that climate anxiety and that guilt that you talk about, that's real for many people, and it comes up, and it's certainly there for the younger generation very, very strongly in terms of the worry about the future. And it's clear that you sometimes feel that as well. The guests talked about it a lot, and there's a lot of rich material in the series of the podcast with turning that kind of eco-anxiety into eco-resilience and to action. So there's a lot of material in there for people who are interested in that. And one of our guests actually runs courses on that, such as the volume of people who are looking to get, you know, stay empowered around this in the face of the data, in the face of those articles in the paper and everything we see. We had the minister and Lorna and Davey all talking about facing the issues head on, and then a sense of what coming together, like the Arden Crusher project and some of those big projects, like when we get it right, when you get the communication right and people come together and align behind something, we are unstoppable. Mm-hmm. and we can cause massive things, and obviously the eye on the target for the healthy planet for ourselves and for future generations now. In this one, Active Hope is another area for people to get into with Joanna Macy and co. Finally, I guess I want to talk a little bit about the future. And maybe this is more of that imagination piece that you were touching on at the end of your last answer. When you think about the future, say, in 2050, what do you see for Ireland?
I suppose it is, maybe I'll give that as two answers and two parts. So when I first started working on climate, which is about 15 years ago, you know, some of the projections that were being made at that time around temperature rise, sea level rise, where our greenhouse gas emissions would be, they were kind of been projected almost like doomsday, you know, and yet we're gone beyond that, and it's actually worse than that now. So on the one hand, when I look to 2050, I think to myself, if we're going to just continue the way we are currently, 2050 is not going to be a good place. And sometimes I find it difficult to shake that feeling. And like, I have to say, when our inventory came out this year, just in the summer, it was in the middle of the heat wave and a European heat wave. And it was that kind of climate anxiety that you talked about was really, really challenging on a personal level, like kind of looking at how do we as an agency communicate the content of these greenhouse gas emissions? Because on the one hand, you want to be factually accurate and you want to be sure that you're getting your message across clearly. But also you don't want to be kind of going on and bringing doom and giving people not a sense of hope. We know the research shows that worry is a great motivator for action, but there is a kind of a tipping point for that, you know, that people feel if they're too worried and they think there's no point, that it just kind of negates any kind of enthusiasm to take any action. So you're kind of thinking about that, and we're certainly thinking about that in the agency as our messaging. How do we ensure that, you know, we point to the potential and we point to areas where there's positives. So that sort of looking at the evidence of what has happened and what's currently there, it's sometimes difficult to look at the future. Having said that, the architecture that we have now in the climate bill and the fact that so many agencies and state bodies and government departments and the apparatus of the state is gearing up and is turning its attention to climate. Like even basic things like every government department now has a climate action unit. They're hired, you know, you're constantly seeing climate jobs being hired. You know, they're looking at it, they're looking for engineers, they're looking for climate scientists. I know myself from recruiting in the EPA, it's incredibly difficult to get these people now because there's just everybody's looking for them. Mm-hmm. So actually that expertise that's going to infiltrate the system, I have to hope is going to have a profound effect. And that gives me great cause for hope. And actually, when I was in the Climate Action Unit in Taoiseach, this was one of the things that we decided we would do in addition to looking at you know, what does delivery look like across the Climate Action Plan and what's the percentage rate of delivery. It was really to look at those systemic issues to see what can we, and we identified an absence of expertise as being a problem across the system. So it's really, really great to see that. And that we know that in previous challenges that the state has faced when we've upskilled and brought that expertise in, it does have an impact. So that gives me great cause for hope, you know, that the system is gearing up for that. I suppose the other thing is that gives me cause for hope, I suppose, is that the future is so much better. In the event that we address our greenhouse gas emissions, the co-benefits that are to be derived, yeah, and what the world will look like, yeah, and what it would mean for my kids and what it would mean for their kids, you know, those of us working on climate, we know that if we reduce the number of cars on the road, that it's going to have a dramatic impact on our air quality. We know the NOx is going to go down. We know that the road noise is going to go down. We know that there are all of these ancillary environmental impacts, which are quite profound. We know that if we, you know, switch from fossil fuels for home heating, that it's going to improve our air quality. And we can see really clear examples, particularly one of the other areas that I have responsibility for in the EPA is our air emissions, and we see that while we're kind of overall in compliance with the exception of ammonia, there are pockets of the country where certain particulate matter, for example, is really, really problematic, you know, that, and it's profoundly causing problems for people's health, and the number of people presenting to hospital and A&E and having problems with their breathing as a result of these issues is really problematic. And we know the future is, if we can successfully retrofit our homes and not have fossil fuels, that those lives will be saved. And so, you know, that future where we are not dependent on fossil fuels and we don't have the emissions deriving from them as a result, and how much cleaner and healthier that will be. And if we have a situation where we can reduce our reliance on nitrogen fertilizer in the agriculture industry and what impact that positive impact that'll have on our waters, for example, these are all future vistas that if we can arrive at them would be just so much better. And that's what the evidence shows us. So that gives me cause for hope and cause for you know, looking ahead to that future. It's a really nice place. I hope we can get there.
Me too. I think listeners of the series will get a good dose of reality, but also a good dose of hope. And they'll hear a lot of stories from our various guests about around these similar questions we discussed today. When I spoke to Davy Phillip, when I went down to Clock Jordan, to the Eco Village there, and when I left, I wanted to go back. I wanted to move there and uproot, you know, pick up sticks or at least think about what I saw down there. Could I bring back to my place? And it was that imagination of you know, spending more time with my neighbours, doing things, swapping vegetables with them. You know, this kind of human level connection that much beyond the technology change that we know is going to be super challenging, and we're talking about a lot. That return to the values and the human connection that somehow I think a lot of us just like deep down innately want to get back is completely linked to taking climate action, and a lot of the stuff we need to do to look after the planet is linked to those values.
Yeah.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really interesting talking to you, and thanks for your insights and your commitment to the work and for sharing it here today. So thanks very much, Sharon.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed our conversation and it's left you in action and hopeful for our future. Please visit seai.ie/podcast for information on each of our guests this season and links to further relevant material to support you around your own climate actions or resources if you are suffering from any climate anxiety. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to 180 Degrees and rate the podcast to help us spread the word.